Hello, hello, and welcome back. Welcome to the Life Without Limits podcast. I'm your host, Yogi Roth, and we are knee-deep in Season 3. Now, I'll apologize off the bat. We missed last week, but it was signing day in the Pac-12 conference, and of course, around the entire community in major college football, small college football, Ivy League college football, every level of college football, it was a day where dreams were achieved. And being a young man who went through that, unfortunately now I get to broadcast on the Pac-12 networks. All my attention went to that, and it was awesome. It was 3 hours. You could check a lot of it on re-airs and Pac-12 networks. Go to pac-12.com or go to any of my social media pages to see some of that content. But it was awesome. His young man's dreams became actualized. Well, today's episode that's going to drop is about a man who's still suitably young. He's right around my age, but he has also actualized a dream. His name is Dan Rubenstein. Now, Dan is absolutely fascinating. This is a young man who grew up in Southern California and just absolutely loved sports and understood what the power of play could do. Inspired him as a young athlete and a tennis player growing up and inspired him to go to the University of Oregon. And he got to that campus when their football program was kind of taken off. And he also arrived on that campus understanding that creativity was something that could be a career. Currently, he's the co-host of one of my favorite, easily top five podcasts titled The Solid Verbal. It's my favorite college football podcast where he and Ty Hildebrandt, the co-host, have been doing it for over a decade. They talk college football and they nerd out twice a week in the season, in the offseason, have really unique conversations around schemes and concepts and take a deep, deep dive. And it's really in a unique place because they're a very unique podcast. Neither one of them played college or major NFL football, but they just love the craft. He also is a huge face and producer at SB Nation, hosting a variety of shows for them. And that's amazing. That's interesting. But what I love most about Dan, like a lot of these guests, is his path. And he has simply just gone for it. I mean, this is a guy who, to get his break, he started on YouTube right when YouTube got going. Then he sent a random note on MySpace. Yep, remember that? And for those of you iGen individuals listening, that was a thing back in the day. You can Google it, MySpace. He sends a note on MySpace, and somebody responds to it. Before you know it, he's 23 years old, and he's creating content on Sports Illustrated around tailgating. And that was before any of the big tailgating shows got going. And Dan just hits it at a young age. And then after a couple of years, he also hits the downturn that all of us in entertainment or any of our professions will always find. And what I love is when his back was against the wall, he got more creative. And I think for him and his story, there's so many people, as we explore this concept of what does it mean to be human and how do we seek our best self, sometimes the best stuff comes out when our backs are against the wall. And now Dan is absolutely thriving. To me, he's a leading voice in college football. He's a leading voice in creativity. And he reminds us that sports are fun and you can blend it and enjoy it in that fashion. Bottom line, sports, simply they provide a canvas. And for Dan Rubenstein, he's made a career out of painting his own story. I think you'll really enjoy our conversation as Season 3 continues to roll on. As always, rate, subscribe, review in Apple Podcasts. I'd love to hear from everybody. This has been an enjoyable season for us, creating this content, sharing this content, and this conversation is right at the top. Get out of the way. Here's Dan Rubenstein.
Oh, and how great is ball? How great is Dan Rubenstein? Dan, we've talked about this one for a long time, bringing you onto the pod, man.
Yeah.
I'm fired up for you to be here. I really appreciate the time.
Of course. Thanks for having me. But you're fired up for everything. So how do I know that you're really fired up for this?
You know, I get asked that question a lot, and I can remember a story once. An executive at a high-ranking television network said, "Hey, Yogi, stop saying the word awesome." And I said, "Okay." I said, "Well, why don't you start saying it?" And he kind of looked at me like, "Whoa, where did that come from?" And I said, "Look, man, like when I have bad days, the difference is I just process them. I don't hold on to them. I'm like, I'll deal with it. If I'm frustrated or angry or upset or sad, like I'm going to get to the root of it and then move on and expect something great to happen next." And it was a great, because he was like, "Whoa, all right, I get it. Okay. And so I am genuinely fired up for you, man.
You keep your desktop of life nice and clean. You put things in the trash, you move forward. You got all sorts of storage and memory.
There, I like the analogy. Okay, so I always like to start this podcast just diving right in. And the whole idea of this is trying to figure out what does it mean to be human. So I want to know, you're a guy who's done a ton, and I set it up and talked about some of your accolades in the, you know, the open of the show. But for you, because we're going to dive into all of those in this conversation, but what do you think the answer is to that question?
What does it mean to be human?
Yeah.
Affecting lives, you know, it's seeing what you are able to contribute to other humans and seeing your power and whatever that means, if that means making people laugh, if that means comforting people, if that means making people think, it is altering the course of other humans, hopefully in a positive way.
Okay. I love that. We're going to unpack that for sure. And I also have enjoying these conversations of asking people, and I think it'll be fun with us. What is the first memory you have of meeting me? And I'm going to tell you my first memory of meeting you, and let's just see if they're anywhere near each other.
I think it was, okay. So my memory is at a movie premiere.
Mm-hmm.
That was for the Todd Marinovich 30 for 30. I think that's where we first met.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah, that is.
And it was a 30 for 30 ESPN movie premiere in Los Angeles. I think we had communicated on Twitter or something like that beforehand, but face-to-face, I don't remember if you were involved in that movie beyond knowing the filmmaker or anything like that, but obviously, with your background with football and quarterbacks and the Elite 11 and ESPN, I am sure somehow you were wrapped up in that. It was somewhere in Hollywood. That's what I remember.
I love that. So similar contextual memory, very similar. We were there. Andrew Stefan is the director, and he's got a new 30 for 30 coming out in early September. It's awesome. It's called The Year of the Scab, about the Washington Redskins. He was just on this podcast a couple weeks ago. I was hanging out with him in Austria. He was running Red Bull films for a while. Yeah, he's amazing. But the thing I remember most about meeting you is that prior to physically meeting you, I dove into kind of like your path. And I was always been fascinated by your ability to create story that has meaning, but you always have fun with it. And to me, that's what sports are, right? They're these amazing stories that like we can remember. Like you can remember if you're an Oregon fan, of course you remember Marcus Mariota, but you can remember back to the Mike Bellotti, Rich Brooks days, and that has a lot of meaning, right? And I say that because you're an Oregon mm-hmm. grad. But it's also a sport. Like we should have a blast. Like why are we always tripping and so serious and so intense and everything is like the biggest thing in the history of the world when it's really about the power of play that brought us so much joy in life. And I've always been fascinated with that about you. Do you recognize that you have the ability to blend sport and fun in a really unique way that, at least personally for me as an observer of your work, I haven't seen anybody be able to do what you do?
Wow. I try. That is the goal at all points because I try to recognize that on the granular level, these are human beings doing extraordinary things that I will never be and have never been capable of doing. And it's sort of an impossibility to me. And I'm moderately athletic. We're talking about a highly respected high school tennis player. But with college football specifically, on the granular level, it's this incredible athletic feat. And then when you zoom out and on, if it's on the media level, whatever, it's entertainment. And it's a weird juggling act because people look at this thing that it, and they look at it very seriously. These fans that consume college football, this is their lives. They're on message boards all year long. They are living and dying with every single play. But at the same time, it's this ridiculous piece of television where you have recruiting and you have these crazy coaches and you have traditions and tailgating. And it's this college football to me, and this was something I really wasn't exposed to until college, which was I didn't really have a favorite team growing up, but college is when I realized how ridiculous it was. Shortly after college, and we can get into it if you want, is when I realized that it's this amazing vehicle, this creative vehicle that I have a canvas for that I can do weird things with. And so it is this thing where I have this incredible respect for the sport and for nerding out over X's and O's and what, you know, really smart people are able to do within the sport. But at the same time, I realize that there's this appetite of people that recognize how ridiculous this all is. And maybe we shouldn't take everything super seriously because it is this great, cool thing. So that's my balancing act. So I'm glad that comes across.
That's interesting because, you know, you can obviously see Dan on Wake Up College Football, listen to you on the Solid Verbal podcast, all over SB Nation, a bunch of different platforms, and you drop in as a guest on shows all the time. When did you realize that you were a creative? You know, like, was it on the tennis court because you were doing, you know, backhands behind your back? You know, like, what was that impetus for you of being a creative outside of the moment when you were in college that you knew you had this canvas, if that's accurate?
Sure. It's a good question. I remember even playing tennis that I really liked doing the introductions for my team and like making up nicknames for the various players. That's what you do in high school tennis. You introduce everybody and everybody sort of shakes hands. And I liked making a big spectacle of it, but it was probably college. I was always sort of a comedy nerd and music nerd. And I got a radio show in college on the college station. I called it Morningwood because I am just a college freshman at heart. And even then I realized that I had a microphone in front of me. I had 2 hours at like 6 in the morning and I could have just played music that I was required to play. But then I decided, you know what, let's play weird game shows. Let's have fun with this with me and my co-host. And I went to school thinking I was going to go into business and become like a sports agent or something like that. But then when I got to school, I realized that I wanted to make things. And so college radio gave me that opportunity. I majored at the University of Oregon in electronic media, which is sort of broadcast journalism and production. And I would always try to make my videos, my news packages, strange or funny or interesting or different. And I spent so much more time on them than everybody else because I was always trying to make them weird. And that's when I sort of realized that I needed to go into something or had to or tried to go into something that would push those buttons, that would get those creative juices going, because I didn't really feel like I had a choice. And so I tried to become a comedy writer out of college, and that path didn't quite work out just because I didn't have the patience to just grab donuts for people. And so I had to be making things, even if I wasn't being paid for them, because I would have ideas and I couldn't get them out of my mind. So it was probably in that college time where I realized that no matter the payment, I need to have some sort of outlet for making. So that's when I probably realized.
You ever talk to your parents about that? Like, did they know that you were that way as a child? Like, were you always building something or making something?
I think so. Yeah, there was always like, there was even in playing video games, I would be broadcasting along with them. I would have friends and we would talk about hosting SportsCenter one day. And so my parents had a good idea that there was, I never acted in school plays or anything like that, but there was a sort of broadcast performance to things that I would do. And there was the sports thing, there was the broadcasting thing. And even like in college, I would make videos, you know, for Father's Day with my brothers acting stupid, stuff like that. So I think they had a good idea that there was something in my brain with entertainment and maybe sports and comedy, something like that. So yeah, I think they had a good idea pretty early on.
You know, that's fascinating on this end. You know, every Friday when I call a game on college campuses, I always speak to the communication school in the Pac-12. And I go in and you hear a lot like, how do I get to be Dan Rubenstein, right? How do I get to be on the Pac-12 network? How do I get to whatever? And my whole thing now is more than ever is that, look, if you want to create a voice, you want to practice it, or if you want a pregame show, like everybody has a smartphone, like you have one, like everybody has Facebook. So we go Facebook Live. You can Periscope it. You can go InstaStory Live, whatever it is. Like, you have the ability to do that now more than ever. And I still feel like as though when I say that to classes, they're like, oh, damn, like, yeah, you're right. For you, you did this. I mean, when did you graduate college? 2004?
2005.
So we're basically the same age. Like,
yeah.
Facebook just got going. There was no Facebook Live. There was no social media. So what was the catalyst to you to start making things? Because I hear all the time from kids that they want to do stuff and all the tools are in front of them, literally on their phone now. But that wasn't necessarily the case for you.
Correct. Yeah. So in 2006, I was working for DreamWorks Animation, doing non-glamorous things, like in the business affairs department, just to make money. I was living at home in 2005 after college, saving up money, and I came up with an idea because I knew I could pull it off on a certain level to go to Pac-10 football tailgates and interview tailgaters. And, you know, the Daily Show existed by then, and there were segments where they'd go out and interview people and get weird responses. And I came up with the idea because football tailgates are inherently weird places where people are grilling and they're drunk and they're loud and passionate, whatever. So you have this incredible space. And I figured, okay, I'm going to go out there. I'm going to interview people. I'm going to have fun. And a lot of those I actually ended up shooting myself. Like, I would take a tripod and a camera. This was my dad's camera at this point. And I would take that. I would film interviews. I had a microphone. I'm doing this for about $20 a week, whatever it cost me for the equipment or travel. And I would shoot about an hour and a half of material. I would come home, and because I knew how to edit video from college, I would cut it down to like a 5 or 6 minute thing. I would probably make it like 3 minutes now if I were doing it all over again. I made my own website using iWeb, a free program for the old Mac, and I would put my videos on YouTube, which was brand new. So even though people now have way more in the way of tools, I still had YouTube. I still had relatively camcorder access. I had a computer. I had a Mac with, I think I used Final Cut Express back then. And I was able to create and publish without a news studio or a TV network or local news, whatever, because I happened to graduate at the right time. So I used the tools available to me to create, and I then built that into something that people would watch because they found entertaining, hopefully, and was able to send out a DVD reel of my work to as many people as humanly possible to watch it. And because the internet existed, you could watch YouTube videos. I could just email people and say, here's what I'm able to do. Whereas if this were 1999, that probably wouldn't be the case. So I got very fortunate, even without Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat, whatever, that enough was available to me. So that's how I came up with the idea. I actually started it because I applied for a job as a writer's assistant on the old show, The Office, on NBC. I thought I was going to get the job. I didn't get the job. And in my head, I said, okay, this was a job that would have involved taking notes and going on donut runs. And I didn't get that job. I might as well take a chance. I'm 22. I'm not married. I don't have kids. I don't have a mortgage. This is the time. And I feel like the people that succeed just go for it. And that was my opportunity. And I saw it to go for it. And I did.
That's amazing. Pause there and take us into your best Pac-10 tailgating story from that first year when you were doing it.
Oh, man. I really liked going to Berkeley, and I really liked going to ASU because they're two very different campuses. You know, Berkeley, there's not even a parking lot. People just sort of tailgate around campus and the city itself. And ASU is this big party school. ASU was my very first episode. I had a camera guy who was just my friend Josh, who had really no experience shooting video. And I interviewed a lot of like sorority girls. One of them asked me to take off my shirt, and it was funny. And I recognized that. And that was the first thing I ever did on camera with college football. And it was really fun. And like, I don't know, 10 or 20,000 people ended up watching it. So that was memorable. Berkeley was funny because I sort of, you got the sense that people were so different everywhere, even though they all loved the same thing, which is college football. And so I asked some question, some like political question about, you know, does this game have more meaning because of what's happening in Darfur? Because obviously Berkeley is this very political campus. And some drunk dude was just like, we will worry about Darfur tomorrow. Today is homecoming and we need to beat Dennis Dixon. And I was like, you know what? I don't know if that answer is offensive, but I love how passionately you felt about it. And that's great. That was so great that these people are all backgrounds. They love college football. And I think that was it. Berkeley was just wild because they were good back then. It's so like going to a game at Berkeley is so different from going to a game at like Ole Miss or Ohio State or something like that. But there's this common ridiculous bond of taking college football way too seriously. And I love it.
Wow. Oh, that is amazing. Okay. So what happens here, and on this podcast, I only have one rule, and it's to ask questions I don't know the answer to. But I do know that your journey on these tours, it caught fire, right? And all of a sudden now you're talking to real outlets, outside of YouTube, right? Like, what happens mm-hmm. next with your business? Because you're super young, you're just going for it. I'm assuming you don't have like an agent brokering deals for you. What happened and how did you deal with the instant success around a really unique idea at the time?
It was successful in that I was able to turn this idea and this concept into a job at Sports Illustrated when I was 23. But at the same time, I was working from home. I was traveling a bunch. It's not like I was on TV every week, and Sports Illustrated was a really cool platform, but I don't know how many people watched it at Sports Illustrated. What happened to get to Sports Illustrated was not an agent, not any like sort of backroom deal. I sent DVDs out everywhere, ESPN, Sports Illustrated, CBS, whoever I could find an address for, an email address, a physical address for. I ended up sending a reel to the MySpace account for SI On Campus, which was a college sports website that SI had. And it was just a blind, here's my reel. I don't know who's going to see this, if anybody's going to see it, but here it is. And Arash Markazi, who is now at ESPN, was the one who was actually manning that account and happened to live 15 minutes from me, really liked my reel. And I grabbed lunch with him and we talked about things and he recommended me to his bosses. And I was actually in this time, I got enough attention where there was a website that did social media for NASCAR and they wanted to hire me and bring me to Charlotte to do NASCAR videos. And I don't know anything about NASCAR, but you know what? It's a full-time job. It's something that will push me creatively, whatever, let's do it. I went to Charlotte. I actually found an apartment and then I heard back a couple times from Sports Illustrated, got the job with Sports Illustrated. They didn't pay me all that much money. I had to like pay expenses out of my own pocket and they'd reimburse me. I ended up making, I mean, not minimum wage, but not much more than minimum wage for shooting video for Sports Illustrated. So it was cool to get notoriety. It was cool to get attention. It was very cool to have Sports Illustrated on my resume, but I didn't fully feel like I had made it in life yet. I just happened to be on a big platform. So I was still pretty humble.
Well, think about it. Like we grew up in the era of, I'm just mm-hmm. assuming here, but from like 8 yeah. to 12, you read SI for kids. And then your parents mm-hmm. were like, okay, you graduated SI. And like you'd fall asleep with it on your face reading about like Dikembe Mutombo or whatever the cover story may have been at the time.
For sure.
And now you're working for them after, you know, you said, I might as well take a chance. And you had to make things. So you took a chance. You made something. And it was SI. It wasn't like this new startup sports website. Like regardless of
right.
money, reimbursement, but you get there and you realize like this isn't maybe necessarily, you know, the creme de la creme in terms of all the bells and whistles, but you still had this platform. How did you vision cast the next step for you? Because you've just continued to grow and a lot of people would reverse engineer that career of like, okay, I'm going to start my own website like you did. And then I'm going to partner with somebody. We're going to create a podcast and then we're going to have like maybe a couple contributing pieces and then SI is going to hire me. Right. You did the exact opposite outside of creating your own website. And I'm curious how you
yeah.
forecast your next step. Cause you easily could have been like, okay, I'm going to be Andy Staples now. And for the next 20 years, I'm going to plot my path to write features and then maybe they'll do some video. And like, how did you see your next step?
I really don't know if I did. I really was sort of in that moment of, okay, I'm going to make things for Sports Illustrated. I'm going to see what happens. I'm going to keep doing things. I did feel removed from the world of Sports Illustrated. I was a contracted employee, so I wasn't a full-time guy. I wasn't working from the New York office. I wasn't around editors. I wasn't doing anything like that where I really felt part of the system. I shot 12 videos, I think, in the fall of 2007. They were well-received. The company really liked them. I think I met my boss once in New York. And then they said, would you like to do other videos, like other sporting events than just college football? And I said, sure. So I did that in 2008, both with college football in the fall. But then during the year, I did other sporting events like the Ultimate Frisbee College Championships. And I went to Krzyzewskiville and Duke. And all these experiences were incredible. I didn't really have a sense of what I wanted to do full time, you know, in the big picture. I just knew that I liked doing what I was doing. I started podcasting in 2008, which was with somebody at Sports Illustrated who is still my co-host to this day, Ty Hildenbrandt. But at this point, I just knew I wanted to keep making videos. I wanted to, like, I was a fan of The Soup on E! And I wanted to make, like, a college football version of that. And I actually did that in my apartment. I set up a green screen. And I said, okay, I'm going to make a funny video every week about the week in college football. And I did that. And that got the attention of other people as well. And then in 2009, as I feel like things are going really well, the recession sort of hit. And they were cutting back on video. They actually sold a series to a sponsor and offered it to me, and I turned it down because I said, that's not what I want to do. That's not my creative vision, like a dumb 25-year-old. I turned it down, and it was like it was interviewing Heisman winners at college campuses. It wasn't the same, you know, interviewing fun fans that were drunk and stuff like that. But I turned it down because that wasn't what I wanted to do as a very stupid 25-year-old who thought he had leverage. And then I was writing a little bit for Sports Illustrated for one of their pages, but not making a ton of money. I made a decent living in 2008, but after that, like, it was sort of a low period where I was podcasting and picking up odd jobs, but my vision for my future was pretty murky at that point. So I really didn't have a clear thought of what I wanted to do other than it'd be cool if I can keep making videos maybe for Sports Illustrated or ESPN or Fox or something like that. That's all I really had in the back of my mind.
That's incredible. I mean, think about now, I'm just imagining all of these, you know, upcoming seniors in college that want to be around sports and storytelling and need to, you know, quote unquote, make things. Here you are kind of laying out the groundwork of, you know, some real concrete steps to do it. I'm curious when, you know, the pseudo recession or the recession hits, right? And all of a sudden, you know, you don't take this job. When fear set in for you, how did you deal with that, if it did?
It's a good question. I poured myself into my podcast, which wasn't making me any money. And the money wasn't really why I was doing it, but I still have to pay rent. I still have to buy groceries, stuff like that. I temped a little bit just around LA just to make ends meet. And I just tried to pursue every avenue I could find. And one of those avenues was, and this was 2010, where I was making a little bit of money writing, but not a ton. I found Eric Rideholm, who produces now PTI and Around the Horn and Dan Lebatard Show and Desus and Mero for Vice. He's a huge producer and was then as well. I found his email address online and I cold emailed him and I said, hey, I did this for Sports Illustrated. If you're ever looking for like a writer or an associate producer for like PTI or Around the Horn. And I was just, you know, emailing whoever I could find their contact information for and sending my resume and my reel, whatever. And he got right back to me and he said, nobody ever leaves my show because everybody seems to have a good time and we treat them well. But if you're ever in Washington, D.C., let me know. And I would be like happy to meet with you and figure things out. And I said, okay. And I was in Chicago, and because my middle brother is a pilot, I get reduced airfare. So I said, okay, I'm going to fly to DC from Chicago because it was super cheap. I had a buddy in DC and I could sleep on his couch. And so I could just quote unquote happen to be in DC. And I had been meaning to go hang out with my buddy, but that the timing was sort of fortuitous. And so I emailed Eric Rideholm and I said, hey, I'm going to be in DC. If the offer still stands, would love to meet with you and pick your brain. And he said, absolutely, come on by the studio, and met with him in DC and could not have been nicer. Gave me contact information for three people who run various things at different sports media outlets, thought my videos were really good and funny and weird. It sort of aligned with his sensibility. And of those three people, two of whom I'm still friends with, one of whom I work for. So it was Jim Bankoff, who is the CEO of SB Nation and now Vox Media. And Ron Wexler, who I think you know from, he was ESPN, now he's at NBC Sports. And I met with Ron Wexler. I met with somebody else at ESPN, a producer named Dave Jacoby, who is now a famous radio dude. And I was able to sort of parlay all of this into appearing on a pilot for ESPNU, which turned into three pilots, which turned into my podcast appearing on Grantland and growing. And eventually, when I was working on this pilot for ESPNU in like 2011 as an on-air host, I came into contact with Spencer Hall and they wanted to hire Spencer for this pilot. And I contacted Spencer because I knew him a little bit from Every Day Should Be Saturday and SB Nation. And I said, hey, would you be interested in doing this? And he said, yes, would you be interested in doing stuff for SB Nation? We're launching a video thing. So that two-year period of cold emailing, traveling across the country, meeting with people, emailing them, meeting with them, it took a long time, but eventually it led to me ending up where I am now. So it was constantly having the foot on the pedal.
You know, it's amazing, and I get the chills listening to that because, you know, you kind of had some fun off the top and talked about how you weren't necessarily like this big jock. You played high school tennis and you enjoyed announcing more than maybe potentially playing. But what you just described in the grit, you know, which is easily simply defined as passion and perseverance, if you're Angela Duckworth on a TED Talk or whatever, you had those cold emails for 2 years. That ain't easy, right? Nothing's easy for 2 years, whether it's a relationship, whether it's, you know, cutting the grass, whether it's going to college. But when your back's against the wall and you don't have a job, or, you know, your livelihood, your dream, your ability to make things, as you beautifully said earlier, is at stake, you leaned in even more. You doubled down on you. And I say that to follow up with the question. I believe, you know, I'm a positive guy, but I believe everybody wants to help. Would you say that you found that out in ways that were unexpected for you as you literally cold called for 2 years?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I did find that people, and I was fortunate that I had my reel and, you know, the proof of concept, the proof of my work, that I wasn't just somebody coming out of college without anything to show for themselves. And that's what I tell people that I speak to, is you have to make things, you have to show people what you're capable of. You can't just say, I want to do this. Like, you can say, I've done X, Y, and Z. You can start blogs, you can have a weird Instagram live channel, whatever it is. But the thing is, people were receptive because I showed that I had drive and I had proof of that I was a somewhat creative person, hopefully. And yeah, people were receptive. People wanted to help. You know, Eric Rideholm to this day is responsible for so much. Arash Markazi wanted to help, but that was because I had something. That was because I had something tangible to show them. And that really helped. And the thing that actually sustained me, that actually also helped to get me hired at SB Nation eventually, was even when I wasn't making a lot of money, even when I wasn't working a ton for the Solid Verbal, my college football podcast, I would edit YouTube videos together. And I knew YouTube, I knew cutting because of college. And I edited an Oregon Stanford highlight with Alex Trebek calling highlights. I would go through a week's worth of Jeopardy episodes and I'd pluck out things that I could use as college football voiceover highlights. I edited an Oklahoma State game to make it look like it was being broadcast on North Korean state TV, because that to me is hilarious. The idea that Bedlam was being broadcast on North Korean state TV. But nobody had really done things like that, to really like screw around with footage and present like weird college football things in strange ways. And because I wasn't just a host, because I wasn't just a producer, because I could edit, because I could come up with these concepts, I was more attractive to people in the long term. And they saw that and were more willing to help me because they knew that at least I was going to pull my end of things. And that was a cool feeling that sustained me, that I could make things and have people respond to it, even if it wasn't for ESPN or Sports Illustrated or Fox or whatever. So it was cool to get that reception from people that wanted to help. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So you're kicking off the 10th season of the Solid Verbal podcast, right? Which is amazing. I mean, there's so much content out there that I think, as an analyst, at least for me in game prep, you know, you can't listen to every beat writer's podcast. You want to, and you try to, but like, I don't run enough to like listen to all those podcasts, you know? And I'm a yoga surf guy, so that means like I'm not connected for a lot of the physical activity in my life. But I really enjoy your content, your view on the game. I'm curious, because there's only a couple times a year when you will see a coach face to face, or we'll see a player face to face, but you have really strong opinions. And I like your opinions. I think they're really accurate a lot of the time. You know, like I couldn't name one that I would have disagreed with, but I think you have a great handle on the game. And for a guy who's not on a college campus, you're not necessarily meeting with coaches all the time. You have built up your community of, you know, I hate the word sources, but your sources in a positive way to learn about the game and learn about what teams are trying to do each week. How do you deal with having strong opinions that, you know, at times will poke fun at somebody, right? But in a fun way, because
sure.
Remember, this is sports and we are enjoying it.
But
yeah. It's a big business in college football where I'm imagining, you know, people that you've talked about at times have been, you know, had some ruffled feathers. And I'm curious what your lens is, what's your backbone there so you stay true to your core, because you've had to last for 10 years.
Sure. Yeah, so I mentioned Spencer Hall earlier, and he has a phrase that it's totally his, but it makes sense when I think about my view of the game. And his phrase is the appreciation machine. And that is, this is this incredible thing. Let's figure out how to appreciate it in smart, weird, creative ways. And I think the big thing is I recognize what I don't know. And there's so much information out there, whether it's, you know, X's and O's, whether it's depth charts, whether it's news. I mean, as you know, college football is a year-round thing. So the people that cover it and cover it well are reading every day or are watching every day. And, you know, there are full games up from like the last 30 years up on YouTube. You can watch it. If you are willing to invest the time, you can look for little things. You can, even if you didn't play college football, if you didn't play in the NFL, you can go on YouTube and you can rewatch a play 15 times to see, oh, look, the quarterback looks this way before he looks down the middle. So he's going through, and you learn terms like progressions, and you sort of get a sense for things. But the big thing is Ty and I recognize what we don't know. And we have people that play the game. We have coaches on. We have people whose jobs it is to write about X's and O's. We have people who, and we're doing a series in this offseason, how college football works, you know, how recruiting works, how coaching hires work. And we talk to people who cover this. So the big thing is Ty and I know that we can talk about the sport in an entertaining way, but the only way we can have the foundation for talking about things in an entertaining way is if we have the foundation of we know what we're talking about. It's funny because we know North Carolina doesn't have a good run defense because we've gone into the numbers. We've watched the tape and we see what the problems are. And we just, that's the foundation. So the big thing is having that roast of knowledge and then seasoning it with entertainment or humor. And that's the big thing that we've found is our secret sauce, is learning as much as we possibly can and then using that to then spring off into figuring out something entertaining, whether it's, you know, knowing Iowa isn't the greatest team in the world, but they have an easy schedule. And over the course of time, we're going to make a joke about talking to your kids about an undefeated Iowa, because it's this weird thing that we weren't ready for. So it really is that foundation of knowledge. And I've told people that I know that work in media that are looking to advance in media, is it's an everyday thing. It's a persistent thing. I mean, you use the term grit. It's looking at what is happening in the sport and knowing that there are 20,000 people who would love to have your job, and you are going to run as fast as you can away from them. And that involves putting in the work. And so that's how, over the years, we've figured out how to just always hit record and post something every week or twice a week. We figured out how to look at the sport in our own unique way and not think, let's try to be ESPN. Let's try to be Fox Sports. Like, no, let's just carve out our own identity and hope for the best. And I think people really eventually ended up really responding to that we were doing something differently in our own way.
I think it's accurate because, you know, like maybe you've dealt with this in your career, because you act as an analyst, in my opinion. Like, I don't, that's how I would categorize you. I mean, it's unique, but I wouldn't say you're a reporter. Like, I wouldn't put you in, like compare you to Bruce Feldman if I had to put
sure.
you in a bucket.
Yeah.
I'd say you're more of like a host slash analyst, like, and really friggin' entertaining. On that note, I just think that your approach is really unique. And I wonder if, have you ever tried to drop yourself into a bucket? Have you ever been like, okay, I mean, you said earlier, you know, you pretended you were, you know, announcing on SportsCenter as a kid, you know, like, did you combat that type of narrative of like, okay, I got to put myself in a box and I'm going to be the guy that puts a suit and tie on and reads highlights really creatively, or I'm going to put myself in a box and it's going to be the guy with never wears a suit and tie and he's going to be really creative, or no, I'm going to be the writer who's got a cool hipster hat and, you know, drinks coffee on Abbot Kinney. Like, did you ever think of yourself in a box, and or did people try to put you in one, and how have you dealt with that in your career?
Not really in a box since Sports Illustrated offered the sponsored Heisman hosting. That was just a sort of interview show. I haven't really thought of that because with the internet, there seems to be an ability for everybody to sort of carve out what they want to carve out. And because I never went to ESPN and said, I want to host College Football Live or I want to host Game Day, mm-hmm. I never really had the drive to think of myself as just a studio host. Even though I do a lot of that for my day job at SB Nation, we tend to think about things in a different way. Whereas, how are we going to be different from everybody? How are we going to host an entertaining show that happens to be about sports? So I really haven't thought about it. I mean, you look around the internet and the sports internet, and you look at places like, or people like, you know, the Men in Blazers for NBC Sports. They used to be at ESPN, and they're these two just entertaining dudes who created their own language about soccer. You look at, they used to be called the Basketball Jones, now the Starters on NBA TV. They're these guys who came together because they liked basketball, and they created a show where they were talking to each other about basketball with their own language and their own terms and their own slang, whatever. And there is this groundswell that I think is sort of buoyed by the sports blog community from like 2005, 2006, when it really got going, where you can be a unique voice and you can pursue a path that you carve without saying, I want to be Bruce Feldman, who's the greatest, by the way, or I want to be Reese Davis, or I want to be Maria Taylor or Samantha Ponder. These are all super talented people who have a passion for what they do in the same way that I think I do, you do, even though you are on TV as an analyst, as a host, whatever, you're sailing around South Africa and you're doing things because there's no reason to restrict yourself because of the tools you have available to you. So I've felt this way for a long time that I can create what I want to create and show that it's good and show that it's high quality and show that it's entertaining, and then go to people who have American dollars and say, let's make an even bigger version of this. And a lot of the time it works, but sometimes it's not going to work and you just have to sort of dust yourself off and move on. But I've always felt it to be a waste of time because of the position I'm in to say, well, I'm just going to go to Oklahoma City or Chicago or Orlando and host a local sports show and hope I go from, you know, a relatively big market to ESPN or Fox. That to me seemed like a waste because it never really was me.
Wow. Talk about knowing yourself. Okay. A couple more. We'll get you out of here. What I'm amazed
sure.
from you, and I talked to, at Pac-12 Media Days, had a chance to connect with Herb Street, and I asked him the same question. You and I have talked about a little bit, but I want to know how you prep, how you react to information. Like, if you took me through your week, you are an encyclopedia, and I get reading everything every day, but you can't just read tweets all day, right? Like, you have to have an organized structure.
Right.
I have one as an analyst. Like, literally, I've just finalized my day-to-day, hour-to-hour schedule that really doesn't have a lot of wiggle room for the next 4 months. Curious for you, because you have the podcast, you have Wake Up College Football, you have other content on SB Nation, you've got your food show. Like, you have a bunch of stuff, and it all stems from being an expert in college football. How do you organize your mind? Now you're, congratulations, married. You've got this other phase
yep.
of your life. Curious. Uh-huh. How you balance isn't the right word, but how you curate your mind in the art of college football.
Yeah, it's a complicated question, a complicated answer. Over summer, I will read as much as I possibly can. Bill Connolly at SB Nation does a great job thoroughly previewing every team. You know, the magazines do a pretty good job, but they come out in May, and a lot happens in June, July, August. So it's paying attention as much as possible to the news cycle. It is watching older games from last season just to get a sense of players that I didn't really get to see or even remember how they played, and just sort of get a sense of that. Once the season starts on Saturdays, I watch all the games, or I don't watch all the games. That would be impossible. I watch games from noon to like 1 or 2 in the morning when the West Coast games end or are ending. I wake up at about, 5 or 6 a.m. I studied for 3 or 4 hours, and that's box scores, that's clips, that's reading beat reporters, that's reading team blogs, just to get a sense of what happened I record Wake Up College Football at around 10 a.m. I record the Solid Verbal around 11 a.m. And in the process of studying, I also figure out what is sort of the big picture thing. What is the serious thing? What is the funny thing? Is there a joke here? Is there insight about what's going on later on in the season? And that's all happening really quickly. And then the season, and then the week starts, and it's a completely different slate of games. And it's more studying from the week before with those sites. And it's talking to people at SB Nation about what we think is interesting. If we want to do a video about Sam Darnold and what makes him great at USC, it's diving deep into him specifically and watching videos and reading about him and seeing what the USC offense does. A lot of it is video that's available to me. Some of it is just reading, but it is recognizing that I can't do a complete job unless I read and watch everything that I can reasonably read or watch. So once I recognize that I'm just not going to do a good job unless I'm prepared, it's understanding that that's my day. That is my job. And sometimes I get it right. Sometimes I'm not as funny as I can be, or sometimes I'm not as smart about something as I can be. And as you also know, you will get that feedback really quickly on places like Twitter or email or whatever from people that watch. But I used to take that personally. Like, I used to sort of hit back, and now I sort of, it gives me a better sense of what that people are actually watching and paying attention to the granular things, and that I do my best job when I'm able to take information and turn it into something personal rather than just spewing the information back. So it is that double process of learning and then applying that takes the longest amount of time, but ultimately will make the best thing. So I haven't gone through a season with a wife yet. I think it'll be okay. She's not crazy about the football season because we can't really make weekend plans, but she understands. So she's very supportive, and I don't anticipate that being any sort of obstacle. But, you know, you also want to have a life. It can't always be looking at the NC State depth chart and knowing that Bradley Chubb is an amazing defensive lineman. It's, you know, sort of taking a step back at times. And yes, Bradley Chubb is a real name. So it is a balancing act. It is tough, but that's, you know, that's a wonderful problem to have.
That's incredible. Within the balancing act, I'm curious for you, mm-hmm. you still have this desire to create, whether it's scripted comedy, whether it's, you know, as you mentioned, you started as a writer, you're working at DreamWorks, even though it was in business affairs, mm-hmm. but do you want to lean down that road? Like in your journey, as you projected out, do you see that side of yourself? Do you see yourself, you know, whether it's stretching and, you know, writing a book, whether it's, you know, creating more unique content, or do you feel like you're in a really unique place right now? And it's about just, you know, what I call it being surgical. I was talking to a friend last night, and I'm like, I've been doing calling games for 9 years. This year for me, it's about like literally getting great at these little incisions, you know, just leveling up and becoming a brain surgeon now and just taking it, you know, incrementally further, because the big jumps, maybe not, you know, we've made those to a certain degree in terms of like your calling games or you have a show. I'm curious how you see mm-hmm. yourself as a creative now.
It's a hell of a question. I certainly feel like I've evolved and I have more big picture ideas, and, you know, taking the Solid Verbal, the podcast, to an even bigger platform is something that interests me, but only if it's sort of on terms creatively that makes sense. I have interests outside of college football, and, you know, I love food. I love travel. I love design. And that's something that I haven't really explored as much as I want to, but yes, the desire to create and to figure out how to make something unique and to look at something at an angle that's a little bit differently. And that's, you know, the podcast and my day job both give me that. But there are certain parameters within the day job and certainly within the podcast as well. You have to do it within about an hour for the podcast. And there's only so many people, and there's only so much time, and there's only so much studio time, whatever, for the day job to do things. So I'm always driven to sort of figure out, how can I create the next thing that will drive me? And it might not be about college football, but the desire to constantly be to make something new and interesting and to offer the world something that either hasn't been offered yet or hasn't been offered in a certain way it's still there. It still burns pretty brightly. And I am a disorganized person, and that's something that holds me back. And that's something that I'm sort of also trying to get past or through or improve upon. And it's an interesting way to go through life as a creative person who needs to organize himself, because I recognize that if I don't, I'm going to hold myself back. And so the concept, the idea that I have to grow up and become an adult in a number of different ways also drives me to figure out how I can give myself the most advantages to create things on the biggest stage possible. So there is that constant push and pull, but yeah, it's the creativity thing still burns pretty bright.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just was scrolling through Twitter, just kind of gearing up for this interview, and I came across an article in GQ that Aziz Ansari was featured in, and I love him. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you do, especially Master of None. It's like it nails your 30s.
Of course.
And he talked about the pressure of fans and people wanting season 3, and his quote was, "My life has not progressed enough yet to write it." And I thought that was like so aware of like we mm-hmm. grow in, you know, sometimes big ways, chunks. You know, you just obviously got married, like you're into another phase. Like, I feel like I'm in one as well creatively. But you have to, I guess the question is, do you feel like you have to go through things in life that impact you personally to allow your creativity to level up to another place?
I think so. Yeah, I think you can very easily get stuck in ruts. And that was actually part of the reason why I took the job in New York, was because I recognized the job with SB Nation. I recognized that I was in not fully a creative rut, but just a personal rut where I needed to jumpstart something. And New York scared the life out of me. The moving to this foreign, cold city, to this job, I didn't know anybody at the job. I knew one or two people in New York. But yeah, there is that sense, and I don't think I'll be in New York forever. And if I move to, whether it's Chicago, where my wife is from, or if it's back to LA, or if it's to Barcelona, wherever, I feel like there does need to, you know, every so often be something in your life that says, all right, we are going to toss everything sort of upside down, make it work. And that's why I really get the Aziz thing, even though his, you know, his life is comedy and creating television and just, I guess, eating everything that's around him. I get that idea where you can't be in a homeostasis constantly and grow. And, you know, if it's having kids, you know, you see comedians who have kids and suddenly their act changes a little bit. It doesn't make it worse. It just makes it different. You know, a coach goes from high school to college, or a coach goes from college to the pros, or whatever. That there needs to be that catalyst to sort of trigger something in your brain that you didn't realize was there. So I totally identify with that.
That's cool, man. All right, last three questions. Try to give mm-hmm. the first thing that comes to mind and try to be as succinct as you can. Question one.
Okay, I'm bad at that. I apologize.
No, I don't mind it. So we'll see what happens. What makes you feel most alive?
Traveling and eating.
Interesting.
With loved ones. No, I didn't say sport. There is something. I was just in Italy on my honeymoon, and I felt something in Italy that I've never felt. And it was that same thing, that sort of going somewhere new, going somewhere different, exploring something. So yeah, that is the most evocative thing I can think of, traveling and eating with loved ones.
I cannot wait to hear how you talk this year in college football, just based on that. And you know me as a huge traveler.
Nice.
I think we go to see a place like Italy and we end up seeing ourselves in a different light. And mm-hmm. I'm freaking pumped. Okay, cool. Question two, what in life are you seeking?
Always happiness. I'm always seeking bliss. I'm always seeking happiness. I haven't really struggled with anything that has inhibited it, but whenever I close my eyes, it's not a money thing. It's just a fulfillment thing. It's personal and professional happiness and bliss.
And you're conscious of that?
Yes.
That's cool. 'Cause that's a great answer, obviously. Like, but the fact that you think that daily within the world that you just described in, you know, 52 minutes, I think it's pretty awesome. Okay, cool. Final question. How do you feel about the word limits?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think much about it. There is so much that can be done personally that it's withholding to think about it.
That's cool. This is awesome, man. We didn't talk about one team or one player. You could do that all day long, and everybody should go listen to the Solid Verbal podcast. But I just think that your path, and now obviously diving into it layers deeper and, you know, deeper tide pool after deeper tide pool, I think that you just have this really cool story that comes off as comedic on air, but you've got an intensity about yourself in terms of your approach. And I don't think intense is like loud and aggro. I think it's like someone that wants to go deep, and to have a show for 10 years, to take the run you did at 22, 23. I think it's really badass, man. So congratulations for whatever that's worth.
Can I ask you a question? And I appreciate it.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Our paths are very different. And so we each were very fortunate to come from really loving families, which not everybody does. And we were each, you know, have our own sort of privileges that, you know, not everybody does. And I think about this a lot, how just fortunate I am to be the age I am, to come from the family that I did. And I'm sure you'd feel the same way. But because our paths are still so different, you came from a small town in Pennsylvania. I'm from Los Angeles. You played college football and, you know, have been broadcasting and making movies, whereas I've sort of been on the internet doing things in a different but still substantial, hopefully, way. Where do you see the crossover in our paths?
I think
because that's also how you started this interview.
Yeah. I think that we're both seekers. I'm on this word like crazy right now. It's my favorite word. If it's the one word I've used to describe me, I would use that, and I'd spell it out as many times as possible, you know, S-E-E-K. And I say that because I take a month every year, and I call it Personal Development Month. And in the month of May, after spring ball, I go around the country to every mentor that I've had, and potentially mm-hmm. try to find some new ones. And what I've done this year is I re-engineered everything that I did in terms of these interviews, or I'd sit down with them, and I created this concept called the Napkin Project. And basically, if you and I sat at a coffee shop, I would give you a napkin, and I'd ask you to answer the following. How do you believe you impact the world? And you'd write down your answer. First thought, first immediate mm-hmm. thought. Then I'd flip over the napkin and ask you, I wouldn't read it, and I'd ask you to pass me the napkin. And I would write down how you impact me. And we would open up the napkin, and we would see if what you believe you're projecting into the world is actually being received. And I did that exercise this past off season, and it was really unique to hear how my content, my path was landing on people, and what I hoped was landing on people. It didn't always match up. It wasn't easy to hear mm-hmm. or swallow. And it made me get really, really clear. What I found is that in all the things that I've been lucky to explore and experience in storytelling, I'm hard to define, right? And I think you would fall into the same category, right? Like, he's a host, he's a comedy writer, he does the food thing, he loves to travel, he's empathetic, he can do, you know, deep dives. We even talk about what you do with the National Football League when you talk to rookies that come out in the NFL. Like,
yeah.
You have all these layers. And what I've been finding is that I was second in a lot of things. And I was like, I got to find the answer to why that is. And I said, I think I've been allowing people to define me in my career and say, yeah, he does a lot of good stuff. You know, and I said, you know, that's no longer going to happen. I'm going to be really clear. So now I define myself as a seeker and an explorer where everything is based in curiosity. And when you listen to me call a game, you're going to get that. I have seeked out what match coverage is like nobody else. You know, I'm going to explore mm-hmm. it all week long watching film. And during the game, I'm going to showcase my curiosity while predicting what I think will happen next. And I'll do the same thing in a film. I hope the same thing happened in this hour long podcast. And I think that's our crossover, is that we're seekers. And I think all of us are. Like, we seek a partner. We seek help. We seek money. We seek a nice house. We seek friendship. Like, we seek. But it took me 35 years to recognize that word. And I think of you as that. You know, I'm not interested in just having a conversation with surface level concepts, right? Like, you know me well enough now. Like, I want to go deep, and I want mm-hmm. to get intense. And that's the word that comes to mind.
I like it. I identify with it.
Cool, man. Seek City, baby. Here we go. I love it, man. Well, thank you. I want to, we'll talk. I love our talks throughout the season. I wish you nothing but the best, man. So much love throughout this fall. And for everybody to stay in touch with you, what is the best way for them to do that?
You can just follow me on Twitter, Dan Rubenstein, R-U-B-E-N-S-T-E-I-N. I post the things there. That should be plenty.
Yeah. You can find all of the links. All of your links will be in the blog and all the show notes, man. So thank you so much for the time, and we'll definitely be talking soon.
Always. Thank you.
All right, and there it is, Dan Rubenstein, Life Without Limits podcast. Some real cool takeaways there. But overall, to me, it was the journey that he's been on. And as I get older and go through this thing, as we continue to seek the best version of ourselves, we can try to plot it out and figure it out. I know I did. And if that was the case, I'd be calling the national championship game, you know, hosting my own show and maybe been on SNL a couple times by now. But that's not the case. And the joy has been in, honestly, and not to be cliche, but the joy has been in the journey and the adventure and the learning and the growth and the community. And I hope that this community is supporting or helping or nudging or just being something fun along a run or a walk or a drive for you, as Dan's story of being an artist, being a creative, and really painting his own way along this path is something I think probably lit up all of us in one way or another. So that's going to do it from here. I'm Yogi Roth. This is the Life Without Limits podcast. You know how we do it. We always end the same way, that the only limits that we have in life are the ones we set ourselves.